Disc 9.
Chapter 35. The Publix at Hollywood Plaza is busy. Edgar Allan Poe walks through the parking lot with his plastic grocery bags, his eyes moving in all directions as he scans for anybody noticing him. No one does. If someone did, it wouldn't matter. No one will remember him or think of him. No one ever does. Besides, he is only doing what is right. A favor to the world, he thinks, as he passes along the edges of the light shining down from tall lamps in the parking lot. He keeps to the shadows and walks briskly, but not anxiously. His white car is like about 20,000 other white cars in South Florida, and he has parked it in a far corner of the lot between two other white cars. One of the white cars, the Lincoln that was parked to the left of him earlier, is no longer there. But as destiny dictated, another white car, this one a Chrysler, took its place. At magical, pure times like this, Pogue knows he is being watched and guided. The eye watches. He is guided by the eye, by the higher power, the God of all gods, the God who sits on top of Mount Olympus, the biggest God of all gods, who is incomprehensibly more immense than any movie star or person who has an attitude and thinks she is an almighty herself. Like her. Like the big fish. Using the remote to unlock his car, he opens a trunk and lifts out another bag, this one from All Season Pools. In the front seat of his white car, he sits in the warm darkness, debating whether he can see well enough for the task at hand. Lights from the lamps in the parking lot barely reach the outer limits where he sits, and he waits for his eyes to adjust, and they do. Inserting the key into the ignition, he turns on the battery so he can listen to music, and he pushes a button on the side of his seat to move it as far back as it will go. He needs plenty of room to work, and his heart trips into gear as he opens a plastic bag and pulls out a pair of thick rubber gloves, a box of granulated sugar, a bottle of generic soda pop, rolls of aluminum foil and duct tape, several large permanent markers, and a package of peppermint chewing gum. The inside of his mouth has tasted like stale cigars ever since he left his apartment at 6 p.m. He can't smoke now. Smoking another cigar gets rid of the stale, dirty tobacco taste, but he can't smoke now. Peeling the wrapper off a stick of gum, he curls the gum into a tight roll and places it inside his mouth, and then opens two more sticks and does the same thing, making himself wait before he lets his teeth sink into the three rolls of gum. And his salivary glands explode painfully, like needles shooting through his jaws, and he begins to chew in big, hard chews. He sits in the dark, chewing. Soon annoyed with rap music, he seeks other channels until he finds what is called adult rock these days, and he opens the glove box and pulls out a Ziploc plastic pouch. Coils of black human hair press against the clear plastic, as if he has a human scalp inside. He carefully withdraws the soft, curly wig and pets it as he looks at the ingredients of his alchemy on the passenger seat. He starts the car. The pastels of downtown Hollywood float past like a dream, and the tiny white lights strung in the palms are galaxies as he moves through space and feels the energy of what's next to him on the passenger seat. He turns east on Hollywood Boulevard, and drives exactly 2 miles per hour below the speed limit toward the A1A highway. Up the road, the Hollywood Beach Resort is massive and pale pink and terracotta, and on the other side of it is the sea. Chapter 36. Dawn is on the ocean, and tangerine and rose spread along the dusky blue horizon as if the sun is a broken egg. Rudy Musil pulls his combat green Hummer into Lucy's driveway and pushes the remote to open her electric gate, and instinctively looks around, looks everywhere, and listens. He doesn't know why, but he is so unsettled this morning that he jumped out of bed and decided he would check on Lucy's house. The black bars of the metal gate slowly roll open, shuddering at intervals along the track, because it curves, and although the gate is curved too, it doesn't like curves, it seems. Just one of many design flaws, Rudy often thinks when he comes to Lucy's salmon color mansion. The biggest design flaw of all was the one she made when she bought this damn house, he thinks, Living like a filthy, rich, damn drug dealer, he thinks. The Ferraris are one thing. He can understand wanting the best cars and the best helicopter. He likes his Hummer, for that matter. But it's one thing to want a rocket or a tank, and another thing to want an anchor. A huge, gaudy anchor. He noticed it when he pulled into the driveway, but he doesn't take a second look or think anything about it until he pulls past the open gate and gets out of the Hummer. Then he backtracks to pick up the newspaper and sees the flag is up on the mailbox. Lucy doesn't get mail at her house, and she isn't home to put the flag up. She wouldn't put the flag up even if she were home. All deliveries and outgoing mail are handled at the training camp and office a half hour south in Hollywood. This is weird, he thinks. And he walks over to the mailbox and stands near it, the newspaper in one hand, the other hand pushing his sun-streaked hair down because it is in cowlicks this early morning. He hasn't shaved or showered either, and he needs to. All night he thrashed about, sweating in bed, unable to get comfortable no matter what he did. He looks around, thinking. No one is out. No one is jogging or walking the dog. One thing he certainly has noticed about this neighborhood is that people keep to themselves and don't enjoy their rich homes or even their modest ones. Rarely does anyone sit on the patio or use the pool, and those who have boats rarely go out in them. What a weird place, he thinks. What an unfriendly, peculiar, nasty place, he thinks angrily. Of all places to move, he thinks. Why here? Why the hell here? Why the hell do you want to be around assholes? You've broken all your rules, Lucy. Every one of them, Lucy, he thinks, as he yanks open the mailbox door and looks inside, and instantly jumps to one side. He backs up 10 feet without thinking, and his adrenaline kicks in before what he's seeing registers. Shit, he says. Holy shit! Chapter 37. Downtown traffic is bad, as usual. And Scarpetta is driving because Marino is moving slowly. The injuries to places best not discussed seem to be his greatest source of pain, and he is walking slightly bow-legged and was awkward when he climbed into the SUV a few minutes earlier. She knows what she saw, but the outraged reddish-purple hue of fragile tissue was nothing more than a silent scream compared to the loud noise pain must be making now. Marino will not be himself for a while. How are you feeling? She asks him again. I'm trusting you to tell me. What she means is implicit. She's not going to ask him to take off his clothes one more time. She will look at him if he asks, but she hopes it won't be necessary. Besides, he won't ask.
I think I'm better, he replies, staring out at the old police department on 9th Street.
The building has looked bad for years, paint peeling and tiles around the top border missing. Now it looks worse, because it is silent and empty.
I can't believe how many years I wasted in that joint, he adds.
Oh, come on. She flips up the blinker, and it click-clicks like a loud watch. That's no way to talk. Let's don't start the day with that kind of talk. I'm trusting you to tell me if the swelling gets worse. It's very important you tell me the truth.
It's better.
Good.
I put the iodine stuff on myself this morning.
Good, she says. Keep applying it every time you get out of the shower.
It doesn't sting as much anymore. Really, not at all. What if she's got some kind of disease like AIDS? I've been thinking about it. What if she does? How do I know she doesn't?
You don't know, unfortunately, Scarpetta says, moving slowly along Clay Street, the huge brown Colosseum crouching in the midst of empty parking lots off to their left. If it makes you feel any better, when I looked around her house, I didn't see any prescription medicines that would indicate she has AIDS, or any other sexually transmitted disease, or any infection of any sort. That doesn't mean she isn't HIV positive. She might be and not know it. The same could be said for anyone you've been intimate with. So if you want to worry yourself sick, you can.
Believe me, I don't want to worry, he replies. But it's not like you can wear a rubber if someone's biting you. It's not like you can protect yourself. You can't exactly have safe sex if someone's biting you.
The understatement of the year, she replies as she turns onto 4th Street. Her cell phone rings, and it worries her when she recognizes Rudy's number. Rarely does he call her, and when he does, it is either to wish her a happy birthday or to pass along bad news. "Hi, Rudy," she says, slowly winding around the back parking lot of the building. "What's up?"
"I can't get hold of Lucy," his stressed voice sounds in her ear. "She's either out of range or has her cell phone off. She headed out in the helicopter this morning for Charleston," he says.
Scarpetta glances over at Marino. He must have called Lucy after Scarpetta left his room last night.
"It's a damn good thing," Rudy says. "A damn good thing."
"Rudy, what's going on?" Scarpetta asks, and she is getting more unnerved by the second.
"Someone put a bomb in her mailbox," he says, talking fast. "It's too much to go into. Some of it she needs to tell you."
Scarpetta creeps almost to a halt inside the parking lot, heading in the direction of the visitor slots.
"When and what?" she asks. "I just found it, not even an hour ago. Came by to check on the place and saw the flag up on the mailbox, which didn't make sense. I opened it, and this big plastic cup's inside, the whole thing colored orange with marker, and the lid's colored green with a piece of duct tape around the lid and over the opening, you know, the little spout you drink out of, and I couldn't see what was in it, so I got one of those long poles out of the garage, what do you call it? Has the grippers on the end for changing light bulbs that are high up. I picked the damn thing up with it, carried it out back, and took care of it."
She takes her time parking, the car barely moving while she listens.
"How did you manage that? I hate to ask." "Shot it. Don't worry. With snake shot. It was a chemical bomb. A bottle bomb, you know the type. With little pieces of tinfoil balled up inside."
Metal to accelerate the reaction. Scarpetta starts going through the differential diagnosis of the bomb. Typical in bottle bombs made out of household cleaners that contain hydrochloric acid, like the Works for toilet bowls that you can get from Walmart, the grocery store, a hardware store. Unfortunately, the recipes are available on the internet.
"It had an acid odor, more like chlorine, but since I shot it by the pool, maybe that's what I was smelling."
"Possibly granulated pool chlorine and some type of sugary soda pop. That's also popular. A chemical analysis will tell."
"Don't worry, one will be done."
"Anything left of the cup?" she asks.
"We'll check for prints and get anything we find right into IAFIS."
"Theoretically, you can get DNA from prints if they're fresh. It's worth a try."
"We'll swab the cup and the duct tape. Don't worry."
The more he says don't worry, the more she will.
"I haven't called the police," he adds.
"It's not my place to advise you about that." She has given up advising him or anyone associated with him. The rules of Lucy and her people are different and creative and risky, and quite often they are inconsistent with what is legal. Scarpetta has ceased demanding to know details that will keep her awake at night.
"This may be related to some other things," Rudy says. "Lucy needs to tell you. If you talk to her before I do, she needs to call me ASAP.
"Rudy, you'll do what you want, but let me just say I hope there aren't any other devices out there. That whoever did this didn't leave more than one, didn't have more than one target," she says. "I've had cases of people who died when these chemicals exploded in their faces or were thrown in their faces and it got into the airway and lungs. The acids are so strong, the reaction doesn't even need to go to completion before the thing blows."
"I know, I know."
"Please find some way to make sure there aren't other victims or potential victims out there. That's what concerns me if you handle things on your own." It is her way of saying that if he doesn't intend to call the police, he should at least be responsible enough to do what he can to protect the public.
"I know what to do, don't worry," he says.
"Jesus," Scarpetta says, ending the call and looking over at Marino. "What in God's name is going on down there? You must have called Lucy last night. Did she tell you what's going on down there? I haven't seen her since September. I don't know what's going on."
"An acid bomb."
He is sitting up straighter in his seat, always ready to pounce if anyone is after Lucy.
"A chemical reaction bomb. The kind of bottle bombs we had trouble with out of Fairfax. Remember all those bombs in Northern Virginia some years ago? A bunch of kids with too much time on their hands who thought it was funny blowing up mailboxes, and a woman died?"
"Damn it," he says. "Easily accessible and terribly dangerous. A pH of one or less, so acidic it's off the scale. It could have blown up in Lucy's face. I hope to God she wouldn't have pulled it out of the mailbox herself. I never know with her."
"At her house?" Marino asks, getting angrier. "The bomb was at that mansion of hers down in Florida?"
"What did she say to you last night?"
"I just told her about Frank Paulson, what was going on up here. That was it. She said she'd take care of it." At that huge house of hers with all the cameras and shit? The bomb was at her house?
Come on, Scarpetta says, opening her car door. I'll tell you as we go in. Chapter 38. Close to the window, the morning light warms a desk where Rudy sits typing on the computer. He hits keys and waits, then rapidly types and waits some more, pressing arrows and scrolling, searching the internet for what he believes is there. Something is there. The psycho saw something that set him off. Rudy now knows the bomb isn't random. He's been at the training camp office for the past 2 hours, doing nothing but maneuver through the internet, while one of the forensic scientists in the nearby private lab has scanned prints and partial prints into IAFIS, and already there is news. Rudy's nerves are screaming like one of Lucy's Ferraris in sixth gear. He dials the phone and tucks the receiver under his chin as he types and stares at the flat video screen.
"Hey, Phil," he says, "big plastic cup with a cat in the hat on it. Big gulp type of cup. Lid originally white." "Yeah, yeah, the type of big cup you get in a convenience store, a gas station, and fill it up yourself. The cat in the hat, though. How unusual. Can we track it?" "No, I'm not kidding. That's a proprietary thing, right? But the movie is not recent. Last year, Christmas time, right?" "No, I didn't go see it, and quit being funny. Seriously, what place would still have cat in the hat cups left after all this time? Worst case, he's had them for a while. But we gotta try." "Yeah, we got prints on it. The guy's not even trying. I mean, he doesn't give a rat's ass about leaving his prints all the hell over the place. On the drawing he taped to the boss's door, inside the bedroom where Henry was attacked. Now, on a bomb. And now we got a hit in IAFIS. Yeah, can you believe it?" "No, don't have a name yet. Might not, either. The hit's on a latent-to-latent search, matching up with partials from some other case. We're checking. That's all I've got right now."
He hangs up and turns back to the computer. Lucy has more search engines in the internet than Pratt and Whitney has jet turbines, but she has never worried that information on the World Wide Web might have to do with her. Not so long ago, she had no reason to worry. Special operatives don't usually court publicity unless they're inactive and hungry for Hollywood. But then Lucy got hooked into Hollywood, and then she got hooked into Henry. And then life changed dramatically and for the worse.
"Damn Henry," he thinks as he types. "Damn her. Damn failed actress Henry who decided to be a cop. Damn Lucy for recruiting her."
He starts a new search, typing in the keywords K. Scarpetta and niece. Now this is interesting. He picks up a pencil and starts twirling it between his fingers like a baton as he reads an article that ran last September on the AP. It is a very short article, and simply states that Virginia has appointed a new chief medical examiner, Dr. Joel Marcus from St. Louis, and it mentions his taking Scarpetta's place after years of limbo and chaos and so on. But Lucy's name appears in the brief article. Since leaving Virginia, the article says, Dr. Scarpetta has worked as a consultant for the private investigation firm The Last Precinct, founded by her niece, former FBI agent Lucy Farinelli. Not quite true, Rudy thinks. Scarpetta doesn't exactly work for Lucy. But that doesn't mean they don't find themselves involved in the same cases now and then. There is no way Scarpetta would ever work for Lucy, and he can't blame her. And he's not sure how he works for Lucy. He had forgotten all about the article, and now he remembers getting angry with Lucy about it, and demanding to know how the hell her name and the name of The Last Precinct ended up in a damn story about Dr. Joel Marcus. The last thing TLP needs is publicity, and there never used to be publicity until Lucy got involved with the entertainment industry, and then all sorts of gossip started leaking into the newspapers and onto television magazine shows. He executes another search, squinting his eyes, trying to come up with something he hasn't thought of. And then his fingers seem to type on without the rest of him, and he types in the keywords Henrietta Walden. A waste of time, he thinks. Her name when she was a B-list out-of-work actress was Jen Thomas or something forgettable like that. He reaches for his Pepsi without looking at it, and can't believe his good fortune. The search returns 3 results.
"Come on, be something," he says to the empty office as he clicks on the first entry.
A Henrietta Taft Walden died 100 years ago, was some sort of wealthy abolitionist from Lynchburg, Virginia.
Whoa, that must have gone over like a lead balloon.
He can't imagine being an abolitionist in Virginia around the time of the Civil War.
Gutsy lady, he'll give her that.
He clicks on the second entry. This Henrietta Walden is alive but ancient and lives on a farm, also in Virginia, raises show horses, and recently gave $1 million to the NAACP. Probably a descendant of the first Henrietta Walden, he thinks. And he wonders if Jen Thomas borrowed the name Henrietta Walden from these somewhat noteworthy female abolitionist types, one dead, one barely alive. If so, why? He envisions Henry's striking blonde looks and uppity, ball-busting attitude. Why would she be inspired by women who are passionate about the plight of blacks? Probably because it was the liberal Hollywood thing to do, he cynically decides, clicking on the third entry. This one is a short article from The Hollywood Reporter. It was published in mid-October. This role's for real. Former actress-turned-LAPD cop Henry Walden has signed on with the prestigious international private protection agency, The Last Precinct, owned and directed by a former special ops, helicopter-flying, Ferrari-driving Lucy Farinelli, who just so happens to be the niece of the famed real-life Quincy, Dr. K. Scarpetta. TLP, which is headquartered in a lesser Hollywood, the one in Florida, recently opened an office in Los Angeles and has expanded its cloak-and-dagger activities to protecting stars. Although its clients are top secret, the reporter has learned that some of them are the biggest names on the A-list and in the music industry, and include such mega luminaries as actor Gloria Rustick and rapper Rat Ridley. "My most exciting, daring role yet," Walden said of her newest escapade. "Who better to protect stars than someone who once worked in the industry?" Work may be a bit of an exaggeration, since the blonde beauty had a lot of leisure time during her stint as an actress. Not that she needs the money. It is well known that her family has plenty of it. Walden is best known for playing small roles in big-budget films such as Quick Death and Don't Be There. Keep your eye out for Walden. She's the one with a gun. Rudy prints the article and sits in the chair, his fingers lightly resting on the keyboard as he stares at the screen and contemplates whether Lucy knows about the article. How could she not be furious if she knew? And if she does know, why didn't she fire Henry months ago? Why didn't Lucy tell him? Such a breach of protocol is hard to imagine. It shocks him that Lucy would allow it, assuming she did. He can't think of a single instance when someone who works for TLP gave an interview to the media or even indulged in loose talk, unless it was part of a highly planned operation. There is only one way to find out, he thinks, reaching for the phone. Hey, he says when Lucy answers. Where are you?
In St. Augustine, on a fuel stop.
Her voice is wary.
I already know about the fucking bomb.
Not what I'm calling about. I guess you talked to your aunt.
Marino called. I don't have time to chat about it, she says angrily. Something else going on?
Did you know your friend gave an interview about coming on board with us?
None of this is about her being my friend.
We'll argue about that later, Rudy says, acting far calmer than he feels, and he is seething. Just answer me. Did you know?
I know nothing about an article. What article?
Rudy reads it to her over the phone, and after he's finished, he waits to see how she'll react. And he knows she will react, and that makes him feel a little better. All along, this hasn't been fair. Now maybe Lucy will be forced to admit it. When Lucy doesn't respond, Rudy asks,
Are you there?
Yes,
she answers him abruptly and testily.
I didn't know.
Well, now you do. Now we have another whole solar system to take a look at. Like her rich family and whether there's any connection between it and the so-called Waldens and who the hell knows what else. But bottom line, did the psycho see this article? And if so, why and what the hell is that about? Not to mention, her acting name is this abolitionist's name, and she's from Virginia. So are you, sort of. Maybe when you got hooked up with her, it wasn't exactly coincidental.
That's ridiculous. Now you're really going off, Lucy says hotly. She was on a list of LAPD cops who work security.
Oh, bullshit, Rudy replies, and his anger is showing too. Fuck the list. You interviewed local police, and there she was. You knew damn well how inexperienced she was in private protection, but you hired her anyway.
I don't want to talk about this on a cell phone. Not even on our cell phones.
I don't either. Talk to the shrink.
That's his code name for Benton Wesley.
Why don't you call him? I'm serious. Maybe he'll have some ideas. Tell him I'm emailing the article to him. We've got prints. Same psycho who did your pretty little sketch also left the little gift in your mailbox.
Big surprise. Like I said, who wants two of them?
I've talked to the shrink, she then says. He'll be monitoring what I do here.
Good thinking. Oh, I almost forgot. I found a hair sticking to the duct tape. The duct tape on the chemical bomb.
Describe it.
About 6 inches long, curly, dark. Looks like head hair, obviously. More later. Call me from a landline. I got a lot of work to do, he says. Maybe your friend knows something, if you can get her to tell the truth for once.
Don't call her my friend, Lucy says. Let's don't fight about this anymore.
Chapter 39. After Kay Scarpetta entered the OCME with Marino slowly following her, doing his best to walk normally, Bruce at the security desk sat up straighter and got a look of dread on his face.
I've been given instructions, Bruce says, refusing to meet her eyes. The chief says no visitors. Maybe he doesn't mean you. Is he expecting you?
He isn't, Scarpetta says with ease. Nothing surprises her at this point.
He probably does mean me.
Gee, I sure am sorry.
Bruce is acutely embarrassed, his cheeks burning pink.
How you doing, Pete?
Marina leans against the desk, his feet spread, his pants hanging lower than usual. If he got in a foot pursuit, he might lose his pants.
Been better, Marino says. So Chief Little thinks he's a big man, ain't letting us in. That what you're telling us, Bruce?
That guy, Bruce says, catching himself. Like most people, Bruce would like to keep his job. He wears a nice Prussian blue uniform, carries a gun, and works in a beautiful building. Better to hold on to what he's got, even if he can't stand Dr. Marcus.
Huh, Marino says, stepping back from the console. Well, hate to disappoint the chief, Little, but we ain't here to see him anyway. Got evidence to drop off at the labs at Trace. But I'm curious. What order did you get exactly? I'm just curious about the wording.
That guy, Bruce says, and he starts to shake his head, but catches himself. He likes his job. It's all right, Scarpetta says. I get the message loud and clear. Thanks for letting me know. Glad someone did.
He should have told you.
Bruce stops himself again, looking around.
Just so you know, everybody's been mighty happy to see you, Dr. Scarpetta.
Almost everybody, she smiles. It's not a problem. Can you let Mr. Ives know we're here? He is expecting us, she adds, emphasizing the word is.
Yes, ma'am,
Bruce says, cheering up a little. He picks up the phone and dials the extension and passes on the message. For a minute or two, Scarpetta and Marino stand before the elevator waiting for it. One can push the button all day and it won't do any good unless the person has a magic magnetic swipe card or the elevator is sent by someone who does. The doors open and they step aboard, and Scarpetta presses the button for the third floor, her black crime scene bag slung over her shoulder.
I guess a son of a bitch canned you,
Marino comments, the elevator car lurching slightly as it begins its short ascent.
I guess he did.
So, what are you going to do about it? You can't just let him get away with this. He begs you to come to Richmond and then treat you like shit. I'd get him fired.
He'll get himself fired one of these days. I have better things to do, she replies as the stainless steel doors open onto Junius Eyes, who is waiting for them in a white corridor.
Junius, thank you, Scarpetta says, offering her hand. Nice to see you again.
Oh, I'm happy to do it,
he says, slightly flustered. He is a strange man with pale eyes. The middle of his upper lip fades into a fine scar that reaches to his nose, a typical poor mending job that she has seen many times before in people who were born with cleft palates. Appearance aside, he is odd. And Scarpetta thought so years ago when she used to encounter him now and then in the labs. She never talked to him much back then, but occasionally she consulted him on certain cases. When she was chief, she was pleasant and made it a practice to show the respect she honestly felt for all of the lab workers, but she was never overly friendly. As she accompanies Eyes along the maze of white corridors and big glass windows that allow glimpses of the scientists at work in the labs, She is aware that the perception when she was here was that she was cold and intimidating. As chief, she got respect, but rarely affection. That was hard, extremely hard, but she lived with it because it went with the position. Now she doesn't have to live with it. "How have you been doing, Junius?" she asks. "Understand you and Marino have been keeping the lights burning late at the FOP. I hope you aren't stressing yourself out too much about this recent trace evidence curiosity." "If anyone can figure it out, you can." Eyes glances at her, a look of disbelief on his face.
"Let's hope so," he says, flustered. "Well, I have to say I know I didn't mix anything up. I don't care what anyone says. I damn well know I didn't."
"You're the last person who would mix something up," she says.
"Well, thank you. That means a lot coming from you."
He lifts a swipe card from the lanyard around his neck and waves it past the sensor on the wall, and a lock clicks free. He opens the door.
"It's not for me to say what anything means," he adds as they walk into the trace evidence section. "But I know I didn't mislabel a sample. I never have, not once. At least not once when I didn't catch it right away and the courts were none the wiser."
"I understand."
"Do you remember Kit?"
Eyes asks, as if Kit is nearby, but she isn't in sight.
"She's not here, is out sick, as a matter of fact. I tell you, half the world has the flu. But I know she wanted to say hello. She'll be sorry she missed you."
"Tell her I'm sorry, too," Scarpetta says, as they reach a long black countertop in Ice's work area.
"Tell you what," Marino says, "you got a quiet place with a phone?" "You bet. The section chief's office around the corner. She's in court today. Help yourself. I know she wouldn't mind." "I'll leave you guys to play in the mud," Marino says, walking off slowly, slightly bow-legged, like a cowboy who just came in from a long, rough ride.
Ice covers a section of countertop with clean white paper, and Scarpetta opens her black bag and pulls out the soil samples. He pulls up another chair so she can sit next to him at the compound microscope and hands her a pair of examination gloves. The first stage of the many in this process is the simplest. Ice takes a tiny steel spatula, dips it into one of the bags, wipes a minute residue of red clay and sandy dirt on a clean slide, and places it on the stage of the microscope. Peering into the lenses, he adjusts the focus and slowly moves the slide around while Scarpetta looks on, unable to see anything except the swipe of damp reddish dirt on the glass. Removing the slide and setting it on a white paper towel, he uses the same method to prepare several more slides. It is not until they are working on a second bag of the soil Scarpetta collected from the demolition site that Eyes finds something.
"If I wasn't seeing this, I wouldn't believe it," he says, looking up from the binocular eyepiece. "Help yourself."
He rolls back his chair, giving her room. She moves closer to the microscope and looks through the lenses at a microscopic landfill of sand and other minerals, fragments of plant and insect pieces, and parts and bits of tobacco, all typical for a dirty parking lot. And she sees several flecks of metal that are partially a dull silver. This is not typical. She looks for a needle-pointed tool and finds several within reach. She carefully manipulates the metallic chips, isolating them, and sees that there are exactly three of them on this slide, all slightly bigger than the largest grain of silica or rock or other debris. Two are red and one is white. Moving the tungsten tip around a little more, she unearths one more find that captivates her interest. This one she recognizes quickly, but she takes her time saying so. She wants to be sure. It is about the size of the smallest paint chip, and grayish-yellow, and a peculiar shape that is neither mineral nor man-made. In fact, the particle looks like a prehistoric bird with a hammer-shaped head, an eye, a narrow neck, and a bulbous body. The flat plates of the lamellae. They look like concentric circles under the layers of bone, like the rings of a tree, she says, moving the particle a little. And the grooves and channels of the canaliculi. That's the holes we're seeing, the Haversian canals or canaliculi, where tiny blood vessels run through. You put this under the polescope, and you should see an undulating, wavy, fan-like extension. My guess is when you get around to the XRD, it's going to come up as calcium phosphate. Bone dust, in other words. I can't say I'm surprised, considering the context. That old building certainly would have had plenty of bone dust in it.
I'll be darned, I says happily. I've been making myself crazy over it. The same damn thing I found in the sick girl case, the Paulson case, if we're on the same sheet of music. Mind if I look?
She rolls back her chair, relieved, but just as perplexed as she was before. Paint chips and bone dust might make sense in the tractor driver's case, but not in Jilly Paulson's death. How can it be that the same type of microscopic trace evidence was recovered from inside her mouth?
Same damn stuff, I says with certainty. Let me get Sick Girl's slides and show you. You won't believe it.
He picks up a thick envelope from a pile on his desk and peels tape off the flap and pulls out a cardboard file of slides.
Been keeping her stuff handy because I've looked at it so many times, believe you me.
He places a slide on the stage.
Red, white, and blue paint particles, some adhering to metal chips, some not.
He moves the slide around and gets it into focus.
Paint single layer, at least an epoxy enamel, and it may have been modified, meaning whatever the object is, it might have started out white and had additional paint added, specifically the red, white, and blue added. Take a look.
Eyes has painstakingly removed all particles from whatever was submitted to him in the Paulson case, and only red, white, and blue paint chips are on the slide. They look big and bright, like a child's building blocks, but irregularly shaped. Some of them adhere to dull silver metal, and some seem to be just paint. The color and texture of the paint seems identical to what she just saw when she looked at her soil sample, and her growing disbelief is well on its way to numbness. She can't think. Her brain is slowing down like a computer running out of memory. She simply can't find the logical connections.
Here's the other particles you're calling bone dust.
He pulls away the slide and replaces it with another one. And this was on her swabs? She wants to make sure, because it is hard to believe.
No question about it. You're looking at it.
The same damn dust.
Think how much of that would be down there. More dust than there are stars in the universe if you started scraping up all the dirt down there,
I says. A few of these particles look like they're old, and the product of natural flaking or exfoliation as the periosteum begins to break down, Scarpetta says. See how rounded and gradually thin the edges are? I expect dust like that with skeletal remains, bones dug up or carried in from the woods and so on. Untraumatized bones will have untraumatized dust, but a few of these, she isolates a particle of bone dust that is jagged and fractured and several shades lighter in color, look pulverized to me. He leans in to see for himself, and then moves out of her way, and she peers into the lenses. In fact, I'm thinking this particle here is burned. Did you notice how fine it is? I'm seeing a little blackish margin. It looks carbonized, burned. But if I put my finger on this particle, it would probably stick to the oil on my skin, and regular flaked bone won't, she says, intrigued. I think some of what we're looking at is from cremains. She peers at the bluish-white ragged particle with its carbonized margin in the bright circle of light. It looks chalky and fractured, but not necessarily heat fractured. I don't know. I've never had a reason to pay attention to bone dust, certainly not burned bone dust. An elemental analysis will tell you. With burned bone, you should get different levels of calcium, higher levels of phosphorus, she explains, without moving her eyes from the binocular lenses. And by the way, I might expect dust from cremains and the rubble and dirt at the old building, since there was a crematorium oven. God knows how many bodies were cremated in that place over the decades. But I'm a little perplexed that the debris from the soil I brought in would have bone dust in it. I scraped that soil from the pavement near the back door. They haven't started knocking down the back of the building and digging up the back parking lot yet. The anatomical division should still be completely intact. Remember the back door of the old building?
Sure I do.
That's where it was. Why would dust from cremains be in the parking lot, right there, on top of the parking lot? Unless it was tracked outside the building.
You mean someone stepped in it down there in the anatomical division and then tracked it out into the parking lot?
I don't know. Possibly. But it appears Mr. Whitby's bloody face must have been against the pavement, the muddy, dirty pavement, and this trace evidence adhered to his wound and the blood on his face.
Take me back to the part about bone dust getting fractured, I says, mystified. So, you got burned bone, and then how does it get fractured, if not by heat?
As I said, I don't know for a fact, but dust from cremains mixed in with dirt on pavement and perhaps run over by a tractor and cars and even people stepping on it. Could bone dust exposed to that sort of traffic look traumatized? I just don't know the answer.
But why the hell would there be cremated bone dust in Sick Girl's case? Ice asks.
That's right. She tries to clear her head and organize her thoughts. That's right. This isn't from the Whitby case. This burn-looking fractured dust isn't from his case. I'm looking at her, Trace.
Dust from cremains inside Sick Girl's mouth? Holy Mother of God, I can't explain that. Sure as heck can't. Can you?
I don't have a clue why bone dust has turned up in her case to begin with, Scarpetta replies. What else have you found? I understand they brought in a number of things from Jilly Paulson's house.
Just stuff from her bed. Kid and I were back there in the scraping room for 10 hours, and then I spent half my life picking out cotton fibers because Dr. Marcus has a thing about cotton swabs. Must have stock in Q-tips, Eyes complains. Of course, DNA had a crack at the linens, too.
I know about it, Scarpetta says. They were looking for respiratory epithelium and found it.
We also found hairs, dyed black hairs on the sheets. I know Kit's been aggravated over those.
Human, I presume. DNA?
Yes, human. They've been sent to Bode for mito.
What about pet hairs? What about canine hair?
No, he says.
Not from her bed linens or pajamas? Not from anything they carried in from her house?
No. How about dust from an autopsy saw?
He says, obsessing over the bone dust.
That could be at your old building, too.
Nothing I'm seeing looks like that. She sits back in the chair and looks at him. Dust from a saw would be fine granules mixed with chunks, and you might also find particles of metal from the blade.
Okay, can we talk about something I do know before I rupture something in my head?
Please, she says.
Thank you, Lord. Now, you're the bone expert, I'll grant you that.
He returns several slides to Jilly Paulson's folder.
But I do know about paint. In both the Sick Girl and the Tractor Man cases, there's not a sign of top coat, not a trace of primer, so we know it isn't automotive. And the bits of metal underneath aren't attracted to a magnet, so they're not ferrous. I tried that out one day, and to cut to the chase, we're talking aluminum.
Something aluminum painted with red, white, and blue enamel paint, Scarpetta thinks out loud, mixed with bone dust.
I give up,
I says. For the moment, so do I, she replies.
Human bone dust?
Unless it's fresh, we're not going to know.
How fresh is fresh?
Several years at most, as opposed to decades, she replies. We can swab fingerprints and get SDR and mito, so it doesn't take much, assuming the sample isn't too old or in bad shape. With DNA, it's quality versus quantity. But if I had to bet, I think we're out of luck. In the first place, with cremains, you can forget DNA entirely. As for the unburned bone dust I'm seeing, I don't know why exactly, but it strikes me as old. It just looks eroded and old. Now, you can send some of this unburned dust off to Bode Laboratories for mito, or even let them try STR, but with a sample this small, it's going to be consumed. Do we want it consumed, knowing we may not get anything anyway?
DNA ain't my department. If it was, my budget would be a hell of a lot bigger.
Well, it's not my decision anyway, she says, getting up from the chair. I suppose if it were, I would vote for preserving the integrity of the evidence in case we need it later. What matters is that bone dust has shown up in two cases that should not be even remotely related.
That definitely matters.
I'll let you pass on the happy news to Dr. Marcus, she says.
He loves my emails. I'll send him another one, Ice replies. Wish I had happy news for you, Dr. Scarpetta. But the fact is, all these bags of dirt are going to take me a while. Days. I'll spread all of it out on watch glasses, dry it good, then sieve it to separate the particles. And that's a pain in the neck, because you have to bang the damn sieves on the counter every other minute to get them to drain into the receiver pan. And I've given up begging for particle separators that have automatic shakers, because they can cost up to $6,000, so forget-a-vous that. The drying and sieving will take a few days, and then it's just me, myself, and I and the microscope. And then SEM, and whatever else we try. By the way, did I ever give you one of my handmade tools? Around here they're affectionately known as eyes picks.
He finds several on his desk and decides on one, turning it slowly this way and that to make sure the tungsten isn't bent and doesn't need sharpening. Holding it up proudly, He presents it to her with a flourish, as if he is giving her a long-stem rose.
"That's very nice of you, Junius," she says. "Thank you very much. And no, you never did give me one."
Chapter 40. Unable to look at the problem from any angle that introduces clarity, Scarpetta stops thinking about the painted aluminum and bone dust. She decides she will soon drive herself into complete exhaustion if she continues to obsess about red, white, and blue chips of paint and particles of probable human bone that are smaller than cat dander. The early afternoon is gray, and the air is so heavy it threatens to collapse like a rain-soaked ceiling. She and Marino get out of the SUV, and the doors sound muffled when they close them. She begins to lose faith when she sees no lights on in the brick house with the mossy slate roof that is on the other side of the Paulson's backyard fence. "You sure he'll be here?" Scarpetta asks.
"He said he would. I know where the key is. He told me, so obviously he doesn't care if we know."
"We're not going to break in if that's what you're suggesting," she says, looking down the cracked walkway to the aluminum storm door and the wooden door behind it and the dark windows on either side. The house is small and old and has a sad face of neglect. It is overwhelmed by bold magnolias, prickly shrubs that haven't been pruned in years, and pines that are so tall and full of themselves they have littered their needles and cones in layers that clog gutters and smother what is left of the lawn.
"Wasn't suggesting nothing," Marino replies, looking up and down the quiet street. "Just letting you know he told me where the key is and said there's no alarm system. You tell me why he told me that."
"It doesn't matter," she says, but she knows it does. Already she can see what is in store for them. The real estate agent can't be bothered to show up or doesn't want to be involved, so he has made it possible for them to wander in and around the house unattended. She digs her hands in the pockets of her coat, her scene kit over her shoulder, and noticeably lighter without the bags of soil that are now being dried at the trace evidence lab.
"I'm at least looking in the windows."
He starts off down the walkway, moving slowly, legs spread a little wide, watching where he steps.
"You coming or hanging out by the car?" he asks without turning around.
What little they know began with the city directory, which was enough for Marino to track down the real estate agent, who apparently hasn't shown the house in more than a year and doesn't give a damn about it. The owner is a woman named Bernice Towle. She lives in South Carolina and refuses to spend a penny to fix up the place or lower the price enough to make its sale remotely possible. According to the real estate agent, the only time the house is used is when Mrs. Towle lets guests stay in it, and no one knows how often that is, or if they ever do. The Richmond police did not check out the house or its history because, for all practical purposes, it is not lived in and therefore not relevant to the Jilly Paulson case. The FBI have no interest in the dilapidated Towle residence for the same reason. Marino and Scarpetta are interested in the house because in a violent death, everything should be of interest. Scarpetta walks toward the house. The concrete beneath her feet is slick with a film of green slime from the rain, and were it her walkway, she would scrub it with bleach, she thinks, as she gets closer to Marino. He is on the small, sloping porch, hands cupped around his eyes, peering through a window. "If we're going to be prowlers, we may as well commit the next crime," she says. "Where's the key?"
"The flower pot under the bush there."
He looks at a huge, unkempt boxwood and a muddy flower pot barely visible beneath it.
"The key's under it."
She steps off the porch and works her hands between branches and sees that the pot is filled with several inches of green rainwater that smells like swamp water. She moves the pot and finds a flat square of aluminum foil covered with dirt and cobwebs. Folded inside it is a copper key as tarnished as an old penny. No one has touched this key in some time, months at least, maybe longer, she thinks. And on the porch, she gives it to Marino, because she doesn't want to be the one to unlock the house. The door creaks open to a musty odor. It is cold inside, and then she thinks she smells cigars. Marino feels for a light switch, but when he finds one and flips it up and down, nothing happens. "Here," Scarpetta hands him a pair of cotton gloves. "I just happen to have your size."
"Huh."
He works his huge hands into the gloves while she puts on a pair too. On a table against a wall is a lamp, and she tries that with success. At least the electricity is on, she says. I wonder if the phone is. She picks up the receiver of an old black princess phone and holds it up to her ear and hears nothing. No phone, she says. I keep thinking I smell old cigar smoke.
Well, you gotta keep power or your pipes will freeze,
Marino says, sniffing and looking around, and the living room seems small with him in it.
I don't smell cigars, just dust and mildew, but you've always been able to smell shit I can't smell.
Scarpetta stands in the glow of the lamp, staring across the small dim room at the floral upholstered couch beneath the windows and a blue Queen Anne chair in a corner. Piled on the dark wooden coffee table are stacks of magazines, and she heads that way and begins to pick them up to see what they are. Now, this I wouldn't have expected, she says, looking at a copy of Variety.
What?
Marino steps closer and stares at the black and white weekly. A trade publication for the entertainment industry, Scarpetta says. Strange. A year ago last November, she reads a date on it. But still very strange. I wonder if Mrs. Towle, whoever she is, has ties with the movie business.
Maybe she's just starstruck like half the rest of the world.
Marino isn't very interested. Half the rest of the world reads People, Entertainment Weekly, that sort of thing. Not Variety. This is hardcore, she says, picking up more magazines. Hollywood Reporter, Variety, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, going back some 2 years. The last 6 months aren't here. Maybe the subscription expired. Mailing label is Mrs. Edith Arnett, this address. That name mean anything to you?
Nope.
Did the real estate agent say who used to live here? Was it Mrs. Towle?
He didn't say. I got the impression it was Mrs. Towle.
Maybe we should do better than an impression. How about calling him? She unzips her black scene kit and pulls out a heavy plastic trash bag, and she loudly shakes it open and drops in the copies of Variety and The Hollywood Reporter.
You taking those?
Marino stands in a doorway, his back to her.
Why?
Can't hurt to check them for prints.
Stealing, he says,
opening a piece of paper and reading the number on it. Trespassing, breaking and entering. May as well steal, she says.
If it turns out to be something, we don't have a warrant.
He is playing with her a little. Do you want me to put them back? She asks. Marino stands in the doorway and shrugs.
We find something, I know where the key is. I'll sneak him back inside and get a warrant after the fact. I've done it before.
I wouldn't admit that in public, she comments, leaving the bag of magazines on the dusty hardwood floor and moving to a small table to the left of the couch and thinking she smells cigars again.
A lot of things I don't admit in public,
he replies, entering a number in his cell phone. Besides, this isn't your jurisdiction. You can't get a warrant.
Don't worry. Me and Browning are tight.
He stares off as he waits, and she can tell by his tone that he's gotten voicemail when he says,
Hey, Jim, Marino here. Was wondering who lived in this house last. What about an Edith Arnett? Please call me ASAP.
He leaves his number.
Huh, he says to Scarpetta. Old Jimbo had no intention of meeting us here. Do you blame him? What a dump.
It's a dump, all right, Scarpetta says as she opens a drawer in a small table to the left of the couch. It is full of coins. But I'm not sure that's why he didn't come. So, you and Detective Browning are tight. The other day you were afraid he might arrest you.
That was the other day.
Marino steps inside the dark hallway.
He's an okay guy. Don't worry. I need a warrant. I'll get a warrant. Enjoy reading about Hollywood. Where the hell are the lights around here?
Must be $50 in quarters. Coins lightly clink as Scarpetta pushes her fingers through them inside the drawer. Just quarters. No pennies, nickels, or dimes. What do you pay for in quarters around here? Newspapers?
50 cents for the garbage patch.
He snidely refers to the local Times Dispatch.
Got one just yesterday out of the machine in front of the hotel, and it cost me 2 quarters. Twice what the Washington Post is.
It's unusual to leave money in a place where no one lives, Scarpetta says, shutting the drawer. The hallway light is out, but she follows Marino into the kitchen. Right away it strikes her as odd that the sink is full of dirty dishes, and the water is disgusting with congealed fat and mold. She opens the refrigerator, and is increasingly convinced that someone has been staying in the house, and not long ago at all. On the shelves are cartons of orange juice and soy milk that have expiration dates for the end of this month, and dates on meat in the freezer show it was purchased some 3 weeks ago. The more food she discovers in cabinets in the pantry, the more anxious she becomes as her intuition reacts before her brain does. When she moves to the end of the hallway and begins to explore the bedroom at the back of the house and smells cigars, she's sure of it, and her adrenaline is rushing. The double bed is covered with a cheap dark blue spread, and when she pulls it back, she sees that the linens beneath it are wrinkled and soiled and scattered with short hairs, some of them red hairs, probably head hairs, and others darker and curlier and probably pubic hairs. And she sees the stains that have dried stiff, and she suspects she knows what those stains are. The bed faces a window, and from it she can see over the wooden fence. She can see the Paulson house. She can see the dark window that was Jilly's. On a table by the bed is a black and yellow ceramic Cohiba ashtray that is quite clean. There is more dust on the furniture than there is in the ashtray. Scarpetta does what she needs to do, and has little awareness of time passing or shadows changing or the sound of rain hitting the roof as she goes through the closet and every dresser drawer in that room and finds a withered red rose still in its plastic wrapper. Men's coats, jackets, and suits, all out of style and grim and buttoned up and primly arranged on wire hangers. Stacks of neatly folded men's pants and shirts in somber colors. Men's underwear and socks, old and cheap. And dozens of dingy white handkerchiefs, all folded into perfect squares. Then she is sitting on the floor, pulling cardboard boxes out from under the bed, and opening them, and going through stacks of old trade publications for mortuary science and funeral home directors, a variety of monthly magazines with photographs of caskets and burial clothes and cremation urns and embalming equipment. The magazines are at least 8 years old. On every one she has looked at so far, the mailing label has been peeled off, and all that is left are only a few letters and part of a zip code here and there, but nothing more, not enough to tell her what she wants to know. She goes through one box after another, looking at every magazine, hoping for a complete mailing label, and finally there are a few, just a few, at the very bottom of a box. She reads the label and sits on the floor staring at it, wondering if she's confused or if there might be a logical explanation, and all the while she is yelling for Marino. She calls out his name as she gets to her feet and stares at a magazine that has a casket shaped like a race car on the cover.
Marino, where are you?
She steps into the hallway, looking and listening. She is breathing hard, and her heart is beating hard. Damn it, she mutters as she walks quickly along the hallway.
Where the hell did you go, Marino?
He is on the front porch talking on his cell phone, and when his eyes meet hers, he knows something too, and she holds up the magazine, holds it close to him.
Yeah, we'll be here, he says into the phone. I have a feeling we'll be here all night.
He ends the call, and his eyes have that flat look in them that she's seen before when he smells his quarry and has to find him. No matter what, he has to. He takes the magazine from her and studies it in silence.
Browning's on his way, he then says to her. He's at the magistrate's right now, getting a warrant.
He turns the magazine over and looks at the mailing label on the back cover.
Shit, he says. Jesus Christ, he says. Your old office. Jesus Christ.
I don't know what it means, she replies, as a soft cold rain pats the old slate roof. Unless it's someone who used to work for me.
Or someone who knows someone who used to work for you. The address is the OCME.
He checks again.
Yeah, it is. Not the labs. June 1996, definitely when you were there, all right. So your office had a subscription to this.
He steps back into the living room, moving close to the lamp on the table, and flips through the magazine.
Then you must know who was getting it.
I never authorized a subscription to that magazine or anything like it, she replies. Not a funeral home magazine. Never. Someone either didn't have my permission or got it on his own.
Got any idea who?
Marino places the magazine beneath a lamp on the dusty table. She thinks of the quiet young man who worked in the anatomical division. The shy young man with red hair who retired on disability. She hasn't thought of him since he left. Probably not once. There would be no reason to think of him. I have an idea, she replies unhappily. His name is Edgar Allan Pogue.
End of Disc 9.